that neither lords nor crown were disposed to regard the traders, planters, and common people of the colonies with any more consideration than they did the yeomen and small cultivators at home. At bottom, the interests of the common man in Great Britain, Ireland, and America were the same. Each was being squeezed by the same system. But while in Britain, oppressor and oppressed were closely tangled up in one intimate social system, in America the crown and the exploiter were far away, and men could get together and develop a sense of community against their common enemy. Moreover, the American colonist had the important advantage of possessing a separate and legal organ of resistance to the British government in the assembly or legislature of his colony that was necessary for the management of local affairs. The common man in Britain, cheated out of his proper representation in the Commons, had no organ, no centre of expression and action for his discontents. It'll be evident to the reader, bearing in mind the variety of the colonies, that here was the possibility of an endless series of disputes, aggressions, and counter-aggressions. The story of the development of irritations between the colonies and Britain is a story far too intricate, subtle, and lengthy for the scheme of this outline. Suffice it that the grievances fell under three main heads: attempts to secure for British adventurers or the British government the profits of the exploitation of new lands, systematic restrictions upon trade, designed to keep the foreign trade of the colonies entirely in British hands, so that the colonial exports all went through Britain and only British-made goods were used in America, and finally, attempts at taxation through the British Parliament as the supreme taxing authority of the empire. Under the pressure of this triple system of annoyances, the American colonists were forced to do a very considerable amount of hard political thinking. Such men as Patrick Henry and James Otis began to discuss the fundamental ideas of government and political association very much as they had been discussed in England in the great days of Cromwell's Commonweal. They began to deny both the divine origin of kingship and the supremacy of the British Parliament, and, according to James Otis in 1762, to say such things as, "God made all men naturally equal. Ideas of earthly superiority are educational, not innate. Kings were made for the good of the people, and not the people for them. No government has a right to make slaves of its subjects. Though most governments are de facto arbitrary, and consequently the curse and scandal of human nature, yet none are de jure arbitrary." Some of which propositions reach far. This ferment in the political ideas of the Americans was started by English leaven. One very influential English writer was John Locke, who lived from 1632 to 1704, whose two treatises on civil government may be taken, as much as any one single book can be taken in such cases, as the point of departure for modern democratic ideas. He was the son of a Cromwellian soldier. He was educated at Christ Church, Oxford. During the Republican ascendancy, he spent some years in Holland in exile, and his writings form a bridge between the bold political thinking of those earlier Republican days and the revolutionary movement both in America and France. But men don't begin to act upon theories. It's always some real danger, some practical necessity that produces action. And it's only after action has destroyed old relationships and produced a new and perplexing state of affairs that theory comes to its own. Then it is that theory is put to the test. The discord in interests and ideas between the colonists was brought to a fighting issue by the obstinate resolve of the British Parliament after the peace of 1763 to impose taxation upon the American colonies. Britain was at peace and flushed with successes. It seemed an admirable opportunity for settling accounts with these recalcitrant settlers. But the great British property owners found a power beside their own, of much the same mind with them, but a little divergent in its ends, the reviving crown. King George III, who had begun his reign in 1760, was resolved to be much more of a king than his two German predecessors. He could speak English. He claimed to glory in the name of Britain. And indeed, it's not a bad name for a man without a perceptible drop of English, Welsh, or Scotch blood in his veins. In the American colonies and the overseas possessions generally, with their indefinite charters, or no charters at all, it seemed to him that the crown might claim authority and obtain resources and powers absolutely denied to it by the strong and jealous aristocracy in Britain. This inclined many of the Whig noblemen to a sympathy with the colonists that they might not otherwise have shown. They had no objection to the exploitation of the colonies in the interests of British private enterprise, but they had very strong objections to the strengthening of the crown by that exploitation so as to make it presently independent of themselves. The war that broke out was therefore in reality not a war between Britain and the colonists. It was a war between the British government and the colonists, with a body of Whig noblemen and a considerable amount of public feeling in England on the side of the latter. An early move after 1763 was an attempt to raise revenue for Britain in the colonies by requiring that newspapers and documents of various sorts should be stamped. This was stiffly resisted. The British Crown was intimidated, and the Stamp Acts were repealed in 1766. Their repeal was greeted by riotous rejoicings in London, more hearty even than those in the colonies. But the Stamp Act affair was only one eddy in a turbulent stream flowing towards civil war. Upon a score of pretexts, and up and down the coast, the representatives of the British government were busy asserting their authority and making British government intolerable. The quartering of soldiers upon the colonists was a great nuisance. Rhode Island was particularly active in defying the trade restrictions. The Rhode Islanders were free traders, that's to say, smugglers. A government schooner, the Gaspé, ran aground off Providence. She was surprised, boarded, and captured by armed men in boats, and burnt. In 1773, with a total disregard of the existing colonial tea trade, special advantages for the importation of tea into America were given by the British Parliament to the East India Company. It was resolved by the colonists to refuse and boycott this tea. When the tea importers at Boston found themselves resolute to land their cargoes, a band of men disguised as Indians in the presence of a great crowd of people boarded the three tea ships and threw the tea overboard on December the 16th, 1773. All 1774 was occupied in the gathering up of resources on either side for the coming conflict. It was decided by the British Parliament in the spring of 1774 to punish Boston by closing her port. Her trade was to be destroyed unless she accepted that tea. It was a quite typical instance of that silly firmness which shatters empires. In order to enforce this measure, British troops were concentrated at Boston under General Gage. The colonists took countermeasures. The first Colonial Congress met at Philadelphia in September, at which 12 colonies were represented: Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, and North and South Carolina. Georgia was not present. True to the best English traditions, the Congress documented its attitude by a Declaration of Rights.
This book is continued on Disc 4.